Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A private funeral service for George Floyd in Houston today. Protests in America continue, and so do the calls to reform policing in this country. Those calls keep growing. Many activists are calling to defund the police. In Minneapolis, that actually means, if the city council follows through with its promise, dismantling the whole police force and building a better one from scratch. In Congress, in Washington, it means newly proposed legislation that's already getting some pushback. So this hour on Point, from defunding to reforming to transforming, reimagining American policing. And we will start today in Minneapolis, Minnesota. City Council member Alondra Cano joins us. She represents the 9th Ward, the ward where George Floyd was killed. And she is one of the 9 City Council members who voted to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department. City Councilwoman Cano, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, explain to us, dismantling the Minneapolis Police Department, what specifically does that mean?
It means that we get to choose what public safety systems we get to invest in and build. So it's less about what we don't want, and it's more about the affirmation of the future that we want.
Mm. So tell me more about that. When you say choose, does that mean dissolving the police department entirely and somehow reconstituting? I mean, what do next steps actually look like?
As you know, 9 council members came together on Sunday to present ourselves as a supermajority of the Minneapolis City Council to say that our current policing system is going to end. We started a process of truth and reconciliation, which we are putting together with our community now, about how we're going to heal, how we're going to center the sanctity of life of every community member in our new system, and how we're going to reimagine that structure. So pragmatically, what that means is a long summer of deep community conversations outside of press conferences, outside of protests, deep listening, restorative justice. And it also means that the council gets to take some significant budget votes this year to align our moral voice with those systems and structures. And it also means that our current policing system will end. Do we have a date for that yet? Not yet. But we are all committed, all 9 of us are committed to ending the current policing system and replacing it with an entirely different operation, a different framework, a different hiring policy and procedure. And frankly, it's unprecedented, but it is very, very, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Now, that 9 member majority that you're talking about constitutes a veto-proof majority on the Minneapolis City Council. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So if you do have to hand over eventually, I just want to understand how sort of the
yes.
city governance works in Minneapolis so we have the right conversation. You do eventually have to hand over some kind of proposal or legislation to the mayor.
Yes. However, with enough council votes, we can override any veto that he might present.
Right.
And so typically the mayor puts together the budget of the city, and then we as a council review it, and we can either approve it as is, change it, or deny it. And in this case, the most direct authority we have over the police department is budgetary.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our city charter, we do know that the department is under the purview of the mayor's office. And while that might be a change that happens in the future, and it'll take a while to get there, I would say anywhere from 1 to 2 years to make that change in the city's constitution. What we have immediate authority over is the budget. And so if 9 council members decided to say, you know what, we're going to completely defund this department, give it a dollar, and create an entire new Department of Safety and Community Justice. We could do that. But we are looking at the specifics of that, what that would entail as in terms of like any rules around HR or around, again, other provisions in the charter that might impact that discussion. But I think we're all clear that the very direct way we can have influence and power over this is through the budget.
Well, the power of the purse is not insignificant, of course. I mean, that's actually an extremely powerful lever. It sounds like the city council has a very big voice in Minneapolis. Now, about so let's focus a little bit on that budgetary power that you have. As you well know, there have been calls in many parts of this country, including Minneapolis, to defund the police. I don't know if you would take it down to a dollar, as you said, but what is the current feeling or thought around amongst city council members about possibly reducing the Minneapolis police to budget significantly?
We have all agreed that the current policing system is coming to an end. We have all agreed to put ourselves on a path towards that vision. Defunding is a strategy of how you abolish the police system, but defunding is not the goal itself. Defunding is the strategy of how you reach the broader vision, which is having a new system altogether and ending the broken one we have now. So many of us agree that defunding is a part of the equation. And right now we're beginning the process of looking at those budgetary needs. We have to wait for the mayor to give us a proposal of what that amended budget for 2020 will look like to correct for COVID-19 losses. And then after that, the council will be digging in to see how much money to redirect to other community safety beyond policing strategies.
Okay. Well, I want to play a moment from our show yesterday where we spoke with Minneapolis organizer Oluchi Omioga. And Oluchi is one of the founders of the Black queer and trans-led organization Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis. So let's listen to their reaction to the city council's decision to dismantle the police department.
I knew that the current policing system couldn't exist in a world where Black people were actually free, but I never actually could envision that future. I never could like actually see that for myself. I just thought of it as a science fiction, right? Or like a fantasy that was like a reality of future generations. But now I can like actually clearly see that this is a reality that could happen in this generation or the next, where folks in Minneapolis don't actually have to grow up with police.
Councilwoman Kano, would you want to respond to that? I mean, that's Oluchi talking about perhaps not even growing up with the police in the future.
I think we are in a very important moment in our nation's history of having a public, community-wide conversation about recentering and reclaiming the safety discussion. Mm-hmm. It's something that I think folks either have feared in the past or have felt was not possible. And so the first step is having that community-wide conversation and affirming that that discussion can be real, it can have a life, it can be part of our ecosystem. And I think that it is a clear and direct response to the fact that no amount of reform on these 100-year-old systems of policing is going to produce the results that we need for communities of color and Indigenous communities. And I'll add that beyond that, I know that our officers also don't think this system is working. Mm. And as the chair of public safety, I have the privilege of working with a lot of officers one-on-one on the ground, learning and understanding what their day-to-day environment is. And I can tell you that no officer wants to graduate from the police academy cadet class and a week later be in court charged for murder. Our officers know this system is limited and it doesn't work for them either. And so what we're saying is we're going to keep that conversation of safety. We're going to keep the system of having help, But what we're going to do is we're going to do away with the old bones that keep racism in our systems, that keep harming our communities, and we're going to build an entire new department or division of what safety looks like with all of this community input and with the possibility of change and the hope for a better future.
Now, you mentioned officers, and previously you mentioned HR issues that will have to be tackled in Minneapolis's efforts here. Is the police union going to be part of these conversations?
I don't want to get stuck in police union issues. What I want to do is be able to work with officers individually who are willing to step into this moment and participate in our truth and reconciliation process, where we will need to sit down together outside of protests and outside of press conferences to come face to face with the harms that have been done, with the hurt and the pain that has been caused, with the challenges we have faced, and have a healing and ceremony recenter our humanity, because these systems do take a toll on both an officer's humanity as well as the community's humanity. And so by centering those pieces and leading with healing and trust and deep listening, then, only then can we start to build a new system. So we are moving at the speed of our relationships and at the speed of our trust. And we are more interested in putting a thoughtful, intentional, constructive process of birthing a new safety mm-hmm. system than we are about abolishing the system tomorrow.
Right. And I just want to say, point well taken, right? This is actually, even though there's a fervent demand for change, I think doing it at the right pace and in the manner that you're speaking, I completely understand. We've got about 30 seconds before the break, so I just want to briefly ask you, though, but if you're looking for long-term structural change, don't you need to include the union, which is one of the key parts of that structure? Councilwoman, do you hear me?
I do hear you. I'm sorry. I heard the music in the background, so I got
no problem. That's one of the vagaries of live radio. So what I'll do is I'll take this quick break, and when we come back, I'll ask the question again and give you a chance to answer. So we are talking about calls to reform, defund, and transform policing across the United States. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the growing call to reform, defund even, but basically transform American policing. And I'm joined today by Alondra Cano. She represents the 9th Ward on the Minneapolis City Council. George Floyd was killed in the 9th Ward there. And City Councilwoman Cano is one of the 9 council members who voted to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department and rebuild it from scratch. In a couple of minutes from now, we're also going to hear from a former member of the Denver Police Force and a currently active chief of police as well. But City Councilwoman Cano, before the break, and I apologize for the confusion there with the music, but I was asking you that you were talking about the next steps, the process of listening and community conversations and creating space for truth and reconciliation that's urgently needed in Minneapolis, that that's the immediate next steps that must be taken. And my question was, in the long run, however, if structural change is ultimately the goal, and I'm hearing that that is the goal, would you not need to include the police union in that process because they are a major part of that structure that you seek to change?
I think the officers have a role. I don't know that the intangibility of a union has a role. So I believe there is a role for the voice of officers who have been a part of policing Minneapolis for a long time, should be a part of this process. And those folks who want to step into this discussion in a compassionate, humble, vulnerable way will naturally, I think, remain a part of the work that happens. I think the folks who came to policing from not all the right reasons will naturally shed out of the process. So I want to champion the involvement of individual officers, but I don't want to get stuck in the politics of the union itself.
Hmm. Now, one more question to you about sort of, and I'm afraid I have to do this, about politics, because we need to understand where various decision makers in Minneapolis stand. As has been well covered, Mayor Jacob Frey was booed out of a rally on Saturday after he said he didn't believe in abolishing the police department. He later said he was going to work relentlessly with the city's police chief and the community, quote, toward deep structural reform and addressing systemic racism in police culture. Can you tell me a little bit about how the city council sees the mayor right now as a partner in these efforts?
I would say that the video that I saw of the walk of shame to me just affirmed that we need a third space for these conversations to happen outside of the attention of a camera or the power of a microphone. Those things are needed, but we also need that deep human listening and openness and willingness to take a risk with our community to provide a different system. I will say that my advice to the mayor has been stop using the word reform. That is a trigger word. That is a word that causes trauma in people in this moment in time. We need to talk about reimagining safety. We need to center healing and justice. We need to talk about what's possible. We need to let go of the fear of the unknown, which in fact has a lot of knowns because there are many solutions in our community, and let go of the familiarity of the dysfunctional system we have. And so in many ways, the work we're doing now is spiritual. The work we're doing now is about deep humanity. The work we're doing now is emotional. And when we center those pieces as human beings, because governing and policing is a deeply human project, only then can we begin to reconstruct systems that, again, many of us inherited, many of us didn't necessarily agree with or want, but we have been trying to reform time and time again, only to see that that sticky, invisible glue of racism and lack of humanity permeate those departments and keep them going in the wrong direction.
Well, City Councilwoman Cano, stand by for just a second here, because I would like to welcome into the conversation Tracy Kazee. She joins us from Denver. She's co-founder and senior vice president of the Center for Policing Equity. She is a 25-year veteran of the Denver Police Department and also served as deputy commissioner of equity and inclusion for the New York City Police Department as well. Tracy Kazee, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be here.
So can you first tell me your thoughts on where Minneapolis is in beginning this process of transforming policing in their city?
Well, I think what you heard the councilwoman say is just that they're in the beginning. How this process, and it is a process, gets rolled out, and how we begin to look at or reimagine how public safety, and I want to reiterate the word public safety and not policing, mm-hmm. Looks to communities is going to be equally as important. What I am 100% about is whatever this looks like on the other side, community has to be centered in this. So right now what we know is that folks want some kind of change, which I believe Minneapolis is absolutely responding to, and being thoughtful about how that process moves forward. And out of the, you know, eye and earshot of media is going to be a key factor, because folks who want to define what safety looks like, they really need to do that in a way in which they are safe and protected to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And that includes the officers as well.
Right. Well, you you wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post headlined "After This Crisis, Policing Should Never Be the Same." And by the way, we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And I'm wondering if you might share with us a little bit about how you begin that op-ed, about what you saw in your own, you know, almost three-decade career as a as an officer and a member of the Denver Police Department.
So I think what most Black folks right now are going through, and I had a friend of mine say this, is a funeral in high definition. Mm. There's grieving, there's anger, there is mixed with hope, depending on the day. And as I watch and continue to watch what's unfolding, not just in Denver, but throughout the country and you know, throughout the world, actually, I'm reminded of my own journey and how I have either been complicit in some spaces, or how I had to make some identity decisions on what I was going to do with my career. I think that the experience of Denver and New York solidifies the fact that, you know, policing is a culture. In some spaces, it may be nuances in the difference, but it's a culture that is shared by all of us who've worn the uniform. And what's interesting about this moment in time, there are things that we know to work. The problems that we've always run into is either there has been a change of administration, there has been lack of interest to follow through or to continue. And overall, for me, there's just been a lack of investment in the Black community and other communities of color. Mm-hmm. And when you are subject to a system that was not designed for your protection, it becomes very problematic. And I think the council person said it best, you know, for me, the word reform was always problematic. When you're about three decades into it and you begin to look at some of the things that are being suggested, these are things that have been going on for decades. And so what we have missing is whether or not what's being unfolded in lots of different departments, do they actually work? For us at CPE, it is about the data collection. It is about really understanding if it impacts, or whatever we decide to do impacts or changes behavior. And so I think that there is a lot of work in this space that still needs to be done. Uh-huh. But as you're talking about how do you think about this going forward, most of the chiefs that we work with understand that programmatic responses are not it. Mm. You have missed the point completely. Mm. We're talking about systemic and structural changes. The concern and the fear is about how that happens. And what does it look like? And what does it mean for the people who don't think the system is broken?
Right.
Because that's the other conversation we're not having as well.
If I might say, that to me seems to be the question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you wrote in your op-ed, I'm just going to quote a couple of sections here. You say, "I want to be clear. I have served with thousands of deeply honorable police officers who do their absolute best to help people." You also say, "I can tell you firsthand that we still have too many officers who subscribe to the belief that specific communities are full of threats to neutralize, not people to serve and protect. A new way of policing, one based on the consent of the community, can never take root in that poisoned soil." So how do we heal that soil? I mean, don't we need to have better levers or mechanisms of accountability to get to that?
Well, it's not just better mechanisms, okay, right? You need the ones that work. So when we talk about holding people accountable to what is going on in policing, first of all, if you look at who's coming into policing, and I think that has always been a conversation about, you know, who sort of navigates or gravitates towards this type of work. The other part of that, just about who's in policing, historically, the conversations about, you know, reform, in quotes, of a police department is based on the diversity, so reflecting the community. And that has been one of sort of the markers held up to being able to, you know, change or impact a department to shift it. And so I know from my experience that if you enter an organization that is not prepared for you as a person, as a you know, as an individual, and you struggle with that particular organization, it really becomes complicated to try to say, we want folks that look like us to do this work. And I'll give you an example. Black officers throughout the country are struggling right now. They're, and this includes chiefs. They're the only group of folks in law enforcement profession that is put in a position, a false position, of having to choose between their community and the career, the chosen career field. And so that additional stress puts us in a place where you see over the last couple of months where you have officers taking a knee, where you have officers linking arms, where you have officers refusing to do certain things that are going to harm or bring further harm to the community. And the other part of this, too, is the disciplinary process. Or as we say, you know, there's systems here. Right. And this is why everything is on the table. A disciplinary system that takes anywhere from a year to 3 years to adjudicate a complaint is not accountable, accountability, not even from a community perspective and not even to an officer perspective. And so we have these systems that were put into place to hopefully remedy some of the issues, and yet we still see some of the same behaviors, and we still see folks that are allowed to continue in this, in the profession of policing.
We're getting a lot of response online to this conversation. So Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, has been monitoring that and is here to share some of the thoughts people have online. What do you got?
Yeah, we've gotten some overwhelming response from listeners who are very skeptical about this idea and are using that word reform is an alternative, as we've been talking about kind of what that word means right now. Stephen Hames on Facebook said, "We endured a 30-year crime wave the last time liberals reformed the criminal justice system. Arrest-related homicide rates steadily decreased over the last 50 years, so there's really no rationale for this change now."
City Councilwoman Khanna, would you like to respond to that?
I would say that our experience is quite different. We created the Office of Violence Prevention built on the successes of our intergroup and group violence prevention program, which works with folks who are involved in either gangs or group violence to de-escalate, to prevent shootings from happening, to help people exit the life if it's possible and able, to provide a wraparound support system. And those kinds of programs have existed in Minneapolis for a while. So we're not talking.
City Councilwoman, you still there? We're going to work to get her back on the line here. Tracy Cazillo, I was wondering if you might want to respond to what the listener was saying.
Absolutely. You know, again, I think what the council person was saying or starting to say, it really depends on where you're situated here in this conversation. And, you know, policing, of course, is always going to be politicized. But as people of color, Black folks in particular, who have had interactions with law enforcement, have a lived experience. And so our experience is how we engage criminal justice is typically pretty different. A lot of the polls have shown that it's pretty different. My concern is you wouldn't have folks demonstrating all over the country if this was not an issue. You would not have police chiefs condemning and trying to figure out a way to move forward if this was not an issue. And what I say to, you know, initiatives that are done by whichever party, there's been harms on both sides. And so what we have to begin to figure out is, how do we do this? What does this look like? And again, I go back to originally, and we can take this back as far back as you want to go with Jim Crow and all of those spaces. When you don't invest in people, then you have problems in regards to how they have to live their lives. And until we begin to deal with those issues, policing or allowing police to be in social spaces, we are still going to have this problem. It is not going to go away.
Mm. And Alondra Cano, I think we have you back. Is that right?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, my apologies for the technical difficulties, but I wanted to give you a chance to finish your answer to the listener's question.
Yeah, basically, I just wanted to make the point that, you know, these community safety beyond policing strategies are not new. We've been investing in them for a while. They have really good outcomes. We want to double down on those efforts and, again, lead with a new system that centers compassion, that centers and protects the humanity of all beings. And we want to shed the old systems that are not working for officers or our community.
Mm. Well, Tracy Kazee, there's another quick question I wanted to ask you that I had touched on with Alondra Cano earlier. And that is, again, maybe I just don't understand it well enough, but in order to really affect systemic change, what should the role of the police unions be here? Because those contracts produce all sorts of rules under which not only the officers, but the cities and the politicians who would have to hold them to account have to play by.
Right. So, you know, in reality, the unions are going to have to be a part of the conversation. So the question is how they choose to show up to that conversation. We've talked about this a little bit earlier, at least you did in your opening segment, about HR and about officers who have contracts. And we're talking about not just impacting their income, but as well as civilians who work in all of these police agencies as well. Mm. So there is a way that, you know, again, to me, it's how they choose to show up to right. What's going on right now.
Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back. So I'll ask you both to just stand by for a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we will be circling back with one of the nation's leading public health experts about the latest in what we know about the novel coronavirus pandemic. So if you have a question, call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 about what you want to know about the pandemic as the country continues to try to reopen for business. That's tomorrow's show. On today's program, right now, we are talking about the renewed national conversation about defunding, transforming, reimagining law enforcement in America. And I'm joined today by Alondra Cano. She represents the 9th Ward on the Minneapolis City Council. And Tracy Kazee also joins us. She's co-founder and senior vice president of the Center for Policing and Policing Equity. And she's an almost 3-decade veteran of the Denver Police Department and the New York City Police Department as well. And joining us now from Inkster, Michigan, is Chief William Riley. He's chief of the Inkster Police Department, a suburb of Detroit, and he was hired by the city there to transform the police force after it settled a police brutality lawsuit in 2015. Chief Riley, welcome to the program.
Hello, welcome. Thank you.
So I think I appreciate your patience because I know you've been listening in for quite some time, and you heard a little bit earlier Tracy Kazee say that Black police officers everywhere in this country right now, chiefs in particular, are struggling. Are you struggling in this moment?
No, to be honest with you, no, I'm not struggling in this moment, no.
Okay.
I'm not.
So tell me more. What have you been thinking? What have you been doing?
Well, you know, I'm not struggling in this moment because one of the reasons why I came to the city of Inkster was to transform it. It was a city that had, unfortunately, had a bad past, issues of policing, definitely disconnected from the community. There was a video of a white officer viciously beating an African-American male on the hood of his vehicle, which, of course, that whole incident basically precipitated me coming in from Selma to the city of Inkster. And they wanted reform. It was clear. I met with several citizen groups, and the message was very clear. They wanted, I know some people like to use the word reform, but that's the, at the time, that's what they were using. They wanted reform. They wanted to change. They wanted a police department that connected with them. They wanted to make sure that accountability was put in place. And one of the reasons when I was approached about the job in Inkster, I make no doubt, I immediately asked, hey, I'm here in Selma, Alabama. You passed a whole lot of cheese before you got to me from the north to the south. And they were very adamant that, hey, we wanted someone not from the area, someone that had a history in transformation, someone that had a history in community policing. And they wanted the main thing, that someone to come in with no connection, not to anything in the state of Michigan, not to a union, not to the old chiefs. And so once coming in, viewing the city, great city, great region, I said, and I only had one question, major question for the people that were speaking with me, and that was, is there anybody in there that I cannot fire? And at the time, the city manager and the guy, they looked at me and started laughing. And I said, really, is there anyone in there that I cannot fire? And the answer was, no, everybody's on the table. And later on, the guy asked me about it. I said, why was that so important? And I told him, it's important because there's no way that you're going to have any type of reform, transformation, or positive change if you've got one person or group or anybody that you feel is untouchable. And it's just not going to work. And the guest, I know they mentioned the union. And yes, I had an opportunity to speak with some people tied to the union, the union representative. And of course, I had to make it clear to them that I was here, you know, for a reason. And if you were doing things right, I would not have to be here. Right. It was plain and simple.
Well, Chief Riley, can I just step in here for a second? Because I just want to ask, and maybe you're getting to this, because what we're also talking about, what I hear loud and clear throughout this hour, is that structural change requires the hard work of cultural change as well. And is what you're saying that, like, you had to have a free hand to root out people, just to, you know, to transform even who was working in the Inkster Police Department to make that cultural change? And have you been successful at that?
Yes, we feel I've been very successful on it. And you're absolutely right. And the councilwoman, I agree wholeheartedly with her about there's, you know, in policing in general, there is a need for transformation. I think that defund, that word defund, this sends a little negative vibe to the police community and to even some communities itself. But I feel that it's not what they're saying, just defund all the police department. I think they're looking, in my opinion, is for full transformation of doing things differently. And that's one of the things I had to do. I had to come in and change the culture and let them know, hey, look, this, everything changes at this particular moment, the moment I took over. You make your bones from this day that I get here. Because, look, I've been in policing over almost 35 years. And one thing I recognize is that when a new chief comes in or a new sheriff comes in, people will act a certain way, or they're trying to be nice, or pretend like they may even try to be competent to a degree. But who they are will soon show up, and that's just the way it is.
Well, let me just get let me give our other guests a chance to respond and share their thoughts here. Tracy Kazee, what's your response to what Chief Riley is saying about his experience in Inkster, Michigan?
Well, I'm pleased that his experience in Inkster you know, worked out and was probably continuing to work the way that it does. When you are talking about not just how do you deal with the culture of policing and reform, there are folks that will always be on board. And that's what I was sort of chuckling if you didn't hear me say. There's people that, that will perform for you. And then eventually, you know, they will show their true selves. But the question becomes one of, in major cities as well, you have, unfortunately, connected to an arrest services. So it's not just about, you know, redoing the culture or trying to make the culture operate in the way in which the community wants it to. This is also providing services to a community where police have often been put in that place. So, you know, the example around the country, when you have law enforcement enforcing social distancing policy, you have law enforcement acting as co-responders to folks that are in mental health crisis. When these systems should be stepping up and pulling away from what law enforcement has often been tasked to do. And this
this is exactly one of the key places in which the funding question comes in, right? Because many people in municipalities across countries would say, well, mental health experts in the town can't step up because there's half or a third of them as many of them as there used to be before, and yet we keep increasing funding for police departments, so we ought to be moving that money around so that we can provide more social services.
Exactly. I mean, and that's what you're hearing, right? So it's not just we want to have public safety in a way that is, you know, comfortable and agreeable, and we've agreed upon and been a part of a process for that public safety. It is when you criminalize certain behaviors that shouldn't be, and when you don't have a place to go to get what you need, or the one thing that we used to have conversations about in policing, why aren't social workers available 24/7, 365 days a week? It's convenient to say, go do this, police, because you're there. And so all of those things are on the table right now.
Well, there's one thing I want to just drill down on very, very specifically here. And if we're talking about structural change, if we're talking about culture, I have to ask about, shouldn't we also be just honestly talking about racism and law enforcement? And let me just play a moment here. Here is Attorney General Bill Barr on Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation. And I just want to play this exchange he had with host Margaret Brennan.
Do you believe there is systemic racism in law enforcement?
I think there's racism in the United States still, but I don't think that the law enforcement system is systemically racist. I understand the distrust, however, of the African-American community, given the history in this country. I think we have to recognize that for most of our history, our institutions were explicitly racist.
That's Attorney General Bill Barr this weekend. Chief Riley, I mean, you hear the Attorney General trying to thread a very narrow needle here, saying that across American history, we've had institutions that were explicitly racist, but not law enforcement systemically right now. What is your response to that?
He missed the point. Missed the point. We have some issues in policing. And as one of the guests mentioned, when some of us, she's been in policing over 30 years, and as myself, when we go back and look at what we had to navigate, even going into the academy and deal with and make those decisions that, you know what, I'm not going to go along to get along. I'm going to be me. And those roads get very tough going into policing. And when you look at what's been going on in America of so many unarmed people of color getting killed, the young lady that got a traffic infraction and winds up, you know, they say she died, hung herself in the jail over a traffic infraction.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you know, all these things of something that are so minor lead to something that is so deadly. And then and you cannot get away from the racist history in America. It was the police department that were the vanguard for racism in America. It was us, our profession, that says you can't drink from that water fountain. You can't go to that restroom. you can't eat in that particular place. It was the plea. So to say all of a sudden, passage of a few laws that went away, it didn't go away. And if those of us that have been in policing know, we've got a group that of officers that the chiefs and the sheriff need to look very hard and making sure that we get them out of policing. But with that said, I go back to the councilwoman. Mm-hmm. There has to be a major transformation in policing and the whole culture of policing, right? Because it there's too much going on, and you really have to be, and I hate using that terminology, you have to be blind as Ray Charles not to see it. But the whole issue is there are things going on. And when we have segments of officers in the United States today that see nothing wrong, that in itself is a huge problem. That how can anybody recognize that leaning on a human being's neck till he dies and murdering them is okay? Right.
Councilwoman Cano, did you want to respond to what the chief is saying about that? Like, really, this is the deeper issue and the work that has to be done to change that.
Absolutely. Excuse me. I want to remind people that the tendency is to try to solve these problems with our brain. And I think we need to start solving these problems with our heart. And at the risk of sounding too spiritual or too, aloof, I do want to remind us that governing and policing is a deeply human project. And we have seen the negative effects of policing in our communities because we have severed the brain from the heart. We have severed this relationship between community care and how we control and how we as a society organize ourselves to follow general agreements about keeping ourselves protected and safe and welcomed. Mm-hmm. And so we have to do that deep human exploration of what does safety mean to me? What does community respect mean to me? What does sanctity of life mean to me? And so I want to ensure that folks understand that we are tired of dealing with the systems that have been handed down to us that grew out of slavery and colonization, and that we're going to break those systems apart. We're going to shatter them, and we're going to start a whole new process to come up with community safety together that honors everybody's experience. And in fact, I think that will provide more freedom, more liberation for our officers, or whatever we end up calling them in the future, to operate in a paradigm. They are also frustrated with the systems. They cannot present and show up in a compassionate way because of all the different dynamics that hold them back and that allow Officer Chauvin to murder someone in broad daylight.
Well, I have one last question, and I'm going to turn it to Tracy Kazee here, because we must also acknowledge that the nation has been here before multiple times in multiple cities, right? I mean, just Minneapolis is a great example. In 2015, there was a Justice Department report, including recommendations about weeding out bad cops and setting clear criteria on what use of force should be. And that didn't happen, right? That it didn't successfully happen. Mm. So what did we learn from that so that we can make sure that these long-term changes this time around really sink in? And I'm so sorry, we've only got about 30 seconds, Tracy, but I'll let you take a shot at it.
Okay, real quick. So I want to say it goes back further than that. If you look at the 1967 Kerner Commission report, it talks about this. And so the question, I guess, for, you know, not just myself, but all of our colleagues in policing is, we know what the issue is. The question is, why are we not moving forward to take care of it? We've been analyzing this for decades. We know what we need to do. The next question is, why won't we do it?
Well, Tracy Kazee is co-founder and senior vice president of the Center for Policing Equity and an almost three-decade veteran of the Denver Police and New York City Police Departments as well. Thank you so very much. And Alondra Cano, city councilwoman for the city of Minneapolis' 9th Ward. Councilwoman Cano, thank you so very much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. Take care.
And Chief William Riley, Chief of Police for the Inkster, Michigan Police Department. Chief Riley, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.